Mike Rabinovich here, and this is the Modelo's Conversations with Data Warehouse Experts podcast series. Our mission in these podcasts is to speak to the best minds in the data warehouse and BI space, and to get their take on the state of the business and find out what they think the future holds. We are also committed to do it in a way that adds value to tech professionals, while at the same time is clear and compelling for the business managers and executives they collaborate with every day. This podcast is brought to you by 7W Data, your go-to portal for all things data. Subscribe free for the latest news and events at www.data.com. That's www.7wdata.com. Follow on Twitter at 7WData. In today's episode, it is my pleasure to speak with James Roland Jones, Principal Program Manager for Microsoft. James specializes in scale-out data solutions such as Azure SQL Data Warehouse, Microsoft Analytics Platform System, and Hadoop. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to begin by asking you to tell us a little bit about your background, where you started out, and the journey that led you to Microsoft.
Sure. So, I mean, I'm as you might get from my accent, I'm actually from the UK, and my journey is not particularly orthodox. I actually professionally trained as a kind of in the legal field. I have a law degree and spent the early part of my career in the legal field. But at about like 1998, that sort of time, I actually cut over and started in IT as one of the many people working in Y2K. And my first professional job was for a company called Logica. And I started working on mainframes at Ford Motor Company in Europe, and learnt kind of a lot of my kind of skills and the trade from colleagues who were working on very large databases and ecosystem at Ford. And I spent about 5 years there before moving on to look at startups. I worked at a company called cheapflights.com, now owned by Kayak, doing like real-time flight price comparison website. And helped to build a lot of the analytics behind that, as well as some of the core engine and performance tuning. But for me, a real kind of seismic event, if you like, was the SQL 2005 launch of SQL Server. And for me, that was a big thing because it's really when I first met a chap called Simon Sabin. And he really introduced me to the community around SQL and the SQL ecosystem in a much broader way. I had a pretty kind of deep knowledge of the product by then, but I was much more kind of just very internally focused. And from that period to about 2008, I was started doing more work with the community. In about 2008, I got my MVP. And from Microsoft and started publishing books on SQL, and I worked with a guy called Christian Bolton and we published the first 2008 internals and troubleshooting book, which was very well received at the time, and really started to kind of grow my influence kind of in and through the community around SQL. One of the biggest achievements that I have in that time scale was I started to work on the not-for-profit SQL Bits conference. Simon was one of the founders of that event, and I was asked to kind of help organize that event and started working very much in the kind of partner ecosystem and sponsorship of events and what I would largely consider to be fundraising for not-for-profit events that really focus on real world education for customers. And in my time doing SQL Bits, which was up to about the end of last year, we had raised over $1 million worth of kind of sponsorship funding to put on events, training thousands of people, hundreds of hours. All the content's available on SQLBits.com is available for free with picture-in-picture video and stuff like that. So there was some really, really great outcomes from that experience. And I spent an enormous amount of time in the community, and I sat on the board of directors for PASS as well, helping to kind of grow the ecosystem globally in a number of different ways. But at the same time, I was really looking at myself and trying to get to how I continue to differentiate my experience. And in about 2010, I started spending a disproportionate amount of my time on scale out data warehousing, having really cut my teeth on the fast track data warehouse, the reference architectures, started getting into parallel data warehouse, then APS, and launched my own company called the Big Bang Data Company, that really focused in this specific area. And really through my community contributions and through my kind of deep knowledge of MPP technologies, I kind of hit the radar of a number of people here at Microsoft. I was contributing to product. I was writing IP for the product. I was doing a whole bunch of things. And in the end, an offer came that was too good to be true, and that was to join the team itself. And so, end of 2014, I actually joined the team.
Oh, that's awesome. But I love the beginning of your journey because, you know, I have to confess that I'm a recovering lawyer as well. So we both started at the same place and ended up in technology.
Yeah,
now, SQLBits, and I digress here a little bit, is that an annual event that still goes on?
Yeah. The next one is actually coming up in February 21 to 24 in the UK. It's the second largest event in the world for SQL and SQL-based technology. And yeah, it's going to be a great event. I'm going to be doing a pre-con there with a partner company in the UK all around SQL Data Warehouse and really helping to kind of share and educate folks in the UK and from all over the world. It really has grown so that, you know, I think last time I looked, something like 10% of the attendees actually are international at least.
Wow.
Now, so it's pretty cool. And there'll be about I'm hoping we'll see about up to about 3,000 people. So that'd be cool.
That's awesome. Now, based on kind of the journey that you've traveled, where have you seen the most significant changes in the data warehouse and BI space over, let's say, the last 5 years?
So in the last 5 years, I think it's pretty clear that it's actually the cloud shift has really kind of transformed how people kind of think about data warehousing, where they want their data warehouse to be, and what it really means for a cloud data warehouse kind of architecture. Key part about the cloud is it does allow you to do things both differently and much more cost effectively than you can think of in an on-premise world. It changes how you think about budgeting and building a solution. So for example, if you think about building a data warehouse on-premise and you're looking at a sizing, you think about, well, how much data do I have? And that's one dimension, and and then how many cores do I need? And you'll make a guess, and then you'll have to put some kind of growth projection on that because the accounting team are going to want to keep that asset around for 3 to 5 years. Mm. So you'll put a growth plan on that, and then you'll want some contingency just in case you got it wrong because it's at the beginning of the project and all that sort of stuff. So you end up with this kind of, what's the max I need plus the max growth plus the max contingency? And they end up having to put a big number in front of this solution before the solution's even been built. And so the projects carried historically a huge weight of expectation, but also funding. It was a massive strategic investment.
Indeed.
Contrast that to the cloud. I can spin up, say, for example, SQL Data Warehouse in 5 minutes or less. I can have as much compute as I want when I want it, and then have as little as I need when I don't use it, or I can even turn the whole thing off. Now, that is a transformational way of thinking about both how you cost and move an analytical solution forward for a customer. And the cloud doesn't kind of stop there. It's enabled us to do things with the product that you just aren't able to do on premise. So like I would consider like legacy data warehouses today, they are very much fixed in the mindset of ratios of compute and storage, right? So, and typically you either overpay in one of those dimensions, right? So those two things are coupled together and you overpay in one direction or another. And in some cases you overpay in both, right? You either need more compute than you have storage, or you have more storage than you have compute.
Right.
But in the cloud, the cloud data warehouses, the more progressive ones are separating those two things out. So it's very much more a concept of you store the data that you have and that you need to have, and then you basically apply the amount of compute, i.e. you just pay for the performance that you need and at the level and at the time that you need it. Pricing is, you know, from seconds per second to per hour, depending on your platform of choice. And that's a huge differentiator to enabling projects worldwide. Right? I mean, those things are, you couldn't even begin to have that conversation sort of 5 years ago.
Let me ask you this. In the course of your day-to-day work, what are the key pain points that you observe businesses experiencing when it does come to data warehousing and ETL?
So I think that depends on whether or not you're looking at a new system or you're looking at existing systems and customers wanting to go on their journey, right? I mean,
Fair enough.
And I think that's a big differentiator, because if you've already got a solution, the key parts are like, the key questions are like, well, what do I need to do in order to be able to leverage my existing assets? And actually, what does that look like? I can tell you that there is a very clear and common theme with those customers, and that's a very clear signal, is that those customers are much less inclined to do what I consider to be a pure lift and shift of their solution. So they're looking at the cloud and they can see the cloud economics, and they're looking to take advantage of other components and services available in the cloud. They're not just picking up that solution like an appliance type model and just saying, right, okay, pick this up, plop it in the cloud, and we'll call it good. Customers are aspiring for more, but they need guidance in terms of how best to achieve that. So there's a lot of kind of conversations about how to do that. What does that journey look like? How do you break that down into steps, etc.? That's one type of customer profile. Then you have the new customer and the cloud-born workloads, and those are different in as much as they don't have necessarily the metadata catalog to kind of understand those things. And so then it's just a question of which services do I use and when, right? And how best to bring all those components together. And I think that's something that we need to do a better job of in terms of helping to kind of accelerate that path of for customers generally.
Based on that comment, do you think current data warehousing tools are adequately addressing these pain points that you raised?
So I think there are some that have very some have very interesting kind of capabilities around like knowledge that they have accumulated through the mappings of ETL, right? And so they, you know, what the sources are, what the targets are, what the transformations are, And so you there's a level of very large accrued metadata in that space. But you stretch that like an on-premise into the cloud, there's a lot of change that's going on in that space. I work quite closely with companies like Informatica that are doing an awful lot to make sure that they're able to kind of connect to a lot of these services and to be able to kind of provide kind of either cloud bursting type solutions or cloud migration solutions. But I think overall we will see more customers looking at simplification of their solutions and how to kind of make as much of this of the surface self-service. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, the need in the same way that you see in business intelligence, the front end piece, they want the data analyst to be doing more. We're seeing more and more kind of self-service coming into the data integration area, data wrangling tools, etc. But I've yet to see something that's kind of completely blown me away, right, in that area that makes that whole thing end to end a self-service perspective.
In terms of data hours generally, there have been articles over the last few years where some pundits have heralded the death of the data warehouse. What's your take on that?
So the first thing I generally say when people talk about data warehouse is it's a theme, it's not a product. So themes generally don't die, right? And neither does the kind of the driving force behind those themes. No one in their right mind goes out and says, you know what, today I'm going to build a data warehouse, right? They're trying to solve certain types of problems, and they're looking to solve answers to questions and be able to do that in a repeatable way. So that's a very, very different way to kind of maybe mentally frame the question in the first place, right? Because if you think about what data warehousing actually is around, actually trying to make sense of disparate data, to be able to curate that data, and then be able to provide that in a form that can serve the enterprise and to be able to serve a business and to be able to share that and to provide consistent, clean, good quality data through the enterprise, you know, none of that changes whether you're doing that in using some big data technologies and trying to do it in that space, or whether you're trying to use a SQL based engine to be able to deliver that type of experience. What I would say personally is that actually what we have actually seen is a broad recognition that SQL as a language is actually a very, very good language to be able to enable very large bodies of users to be able to consume data, right? It's a very intuitive, very easy language. If we look at how many people actually understand it conceptually, it's a very, very large body of people. So the management of change when you have SQL-based language is much better, is much less. You can even see it in the big data space. The number of the big data technologies that now expose SQL as a capability. But what those solutions have is SQL as a language. What they don't necessarily have is the many thousands, millions of hours of man years in creating SQL as an engine, right, to back that capability. And that's where SQL-based engines as those queries become more complex, the insights that people are trying to get out of the data is more involved. A SQL engine is much, much better suited to be able to actually answer the question, to be actually run that type of processing. Both SQL engines and SQL as a language, I can see a very rich and very vibrant future for. What I think we will see much more interesting areas is really about how those technologies and how technologies like SQL Data Warehouse will actually integrate into that ecosystem, such that the data that is shared into the enterprise is accessible, right? That's an area that's very interesting to be able to discuss and pursue.
What's your take on the role automation can play in the making, design, and build of data warehouses in a way that's faster and more cost effective, especially when we look at the exponential increase in data flows and data complexity?
Yeah, so I think this is an area that is somewhat rich, is a rich vein of opportunity. As I was saying earlier, I don't think that this has necessarily been kind of knocked out of the park by anybody yet. I can see that there's a lot of investment in automation and actually, especially one of the things that I've seen at various companies is when you have actually very simple transformations required, but across a large number of sources, right?
Yes.
Where if someone doesn't want to spend a large amount of money, basically just taking those sources and just mapping those out. If you can do that through code generation, that's obviously a huge boon for everybody. You have technology stacks like Varigence and Bimal, for example, in the SQList space, and you can see that integration coming through in Azure Data Factory, right? So those APIs and being able to build that stuff programmatically, such that code generation is a very attainable goal. It has been on the rise for some time. It's currently, I would say, at the point where it still requires kind of more professional you still need a data engineer to be building that stuff rather than it being like a data analyst. But I can see that directionally over time that that will become more of a commoditized skill.
Now, when you deal with different businesses and different C-suites within those businesses, what we see when we do our project at the Modlo is that there's a real knowledge gap between the IT department that sometimes really gets this and the C-suite that has to be convinced to make the budgets available and to push the project forward. So is there one resource that you can recommend to executives and middle managers to help them on their BI journey?
So I still come from very much the data integration side of the house, much more than the data visualization space or even from the business intelligence side. But I will say that the resources that I use and reference are things like Chris Webb's BI blog and like the fine chaps at SQL BI, so Marco Russo and Alberto Ferrari. I find that they have a very interesting perspective in terms of what the developments are in terms of business intelligence, and they are good resources generally, and they have put, and I know they've collaborated with like Rafael on a project Botticelli to build videos and stuff like that. So there's educational material and their books are very well respected. Generally speaking, I find that the C exec level people, they have a much more a simplified view of what they're actually trying to achieve. But not necessarily the understanding on how to get there. So the tools that actually are able to kind of visualize that for them as quickly as possible are the ones that kind of get the most traction.
That's a great way of putting it. What I would love if you could is send us the links and these resources you mentioned, and I'll share it in the blog post when we create a link to your to this podcast, if that's okay.
Yeah, no problem.
That's awesome. So now I want to switch gears and to the segment of the show where we get to know our guests a little bit better, some lighter fare. So the first question is, what is your current TV shows, the one you go to binge or to relax?
Well, I'm not a huge TV watcher, but the one that I'm watching at the moment is series one of American Gods. My wife and I are currently at episode 6 of 8. I'm not even sure I can even tell you what's going on, because I think the whole point of the show is that you actually have no idea what's going on right up until the end. So don't ask me what it actually all means, because I'm still struggling to find that out myself. I'm actually more of a kind of a comic book guy, and the fact that this is a Neil Gaiman show is the attraction for me. I'm a huge Sandman fan, so just seeing that all kind of come to life is interesting.
Well, you know, my kids are big fans. I haven't watched it yet. It might be too scary for me, but they rave about it.
Yeah, it makes Game of Thrones look tame on the blood front, I can tell you that.
Wow. Yeah. That's a real marker there. Wow. Yeah. So on to the next question. What is the best non-tech book you've read in the past few months and that you'd recommend or gift to your friends?
So this one is going to be very much depending on the friend, I would say. But the book that I have actually both enjoyed reading and actually learned the most from actually is a book called Monetizing Innovation. And it's all about, it's actually very much about product development and how different product methodologies and how different companies have succeeded and failed with their way of bringing a product to market and how they've actually done that. And they look at various case studies, and they're looking at as well very much from a point of view of value and like what aspects to company to customers value, and how you actually think about valuing innovation and features and where they actually sit. So it's not particularly kind of non-fiction or non-technical, right? But for my role, if you like, this has been a big area of kind of growth for me in the last sort of 2 years as I've come into a product management kind of discipline, actually coming out of consultancy into product management, and this book has really spoken to me in a way that I, you know, across my peers, should I say, this is the book that I would recommend or share or have given to others to read.
Who is the author?
Oh, yeah, I knew you were going to say that. I can say, go, if you just type in monetizing innovation.
I'll Google it. I want to add a link to it as well, because I think that's, you know, from your perspective, if you get something out of it, I think others would as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So I would encourage anyone to read it, and it's not expensive at all.
So now to conclude the podcast, first of all, I much appreciate your time. And I'd like to find out, where can our listeners find out more about you on the web?
So I put a lot of my energy into our product documentation. So you'll see my ugly little face on in the little circles on many of our product docs. When I'm blogging, if I'm writing blogs, I'll write them on the Azure blog. And any videos kind of go up on Channel 9. That's why I try to make as much of what I'm doing as public as possible, such that it's available for everybody in that way, and has the most impact to the thing that I care passionately about, and that's the success of Azure SQL Data Warehouse. And I really want to invest my kind of exposure into that.
So obviously we can find you on LinkedIn as well, as you and I are linked up. And are you on what's your Twitter handle?
Just @JRolandJones.
Awesome.
Yeah.
At James Roland Jones, and I will share that as well.
Yeah, at J. Roland Jones. So it's most people just know me as just JRJ, and
I
so
know,
like,
I thought that
everything
might be
else
Twitter
is
handle.
Just, yeah. So I think several million people beat me to that. Met most of them probably watched. So that unfortunately had been taken, but yeah.
We'll include yours in the notes as well. Well, thanks so much for your time today, James. Much appreciated. And I hope we get a chance to do this again.
Yeah, I'd look forward to it. Thanks
awesome.
Very
Have
much.
Have a great one.